Lecture 26, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persum, November 8, 2006.
Okay, let's get started. Pass out homework 5. A couple of notes. One is it's due on Monday, November 20th, as opposed to the previous Friday. The reason for this is that I'll be out of town Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, as stated on the syllabus, which means office hours will be canceled Wednesday. As it turns out, my two TAs are also going to the same conference, so their office hours cannot be moved earlier. So since we won't have office hours till Thursday and Friday, we move the homework assignment due till Monday. However, that next Monday is Thanksgiving week, and there's no class that entire week. And as a result, there'll be no class on Monday, November 20th. And so you can't turn it in class because I won't be here. Instead, you'll turn in Nathan Yoder's mailbox, which is in 2032 Cook Hall, which is right next to the department, Material Science Department office. And it's due by 5 o'clock on that day. If you prefer, you can bring it on the previous Friday. I'll take it in class, but I want to give this extra time. The first problem is concerning the behavior of soft phonon modes in ionic solids. And what's interesting here is, in addition to a harmonic behavior, that is a Hooke's law behavior for nearest neighbors, which we assumed thus far in our analysis of phonons, because in an ionic lattice you have charges present, you'll have long-range electrostatic interactions as well. Those long-range electrostatic interactions will exist not only with nearest neighbors, but with all of the ions in the lattice. And as a result, what you're going to have to do is develop an infinite sum over all of the atoms in the lattice to develop the dispersion relation for the soft phonon modes. And I try to hold your hand through the analysis by having you solve some things on the way to the end result, which is part B, the phonon dispersion relation. And you see that it's an infinite sum. We then consider some properties of this dispersion relation. In particular, we find that omega squared will become negative for some particular value of sigma, where sigma is a function of the lattice constant, the charge of the electron, and the linear force constant of the solid. What that implies when omega squared goes negative is that you have an unstable mode. When omega squared is zero, you can have spontaneous distortions of the lattice. This is very important for the theory of phase transitions. In particular, the phase transition which is most relevant for ionic solids is ferroelectric phase transition. And the properties of ferroelectrics come back to the behavior of soft phonon modes. So that's where you're going with this problem. So you'll determine some constraints on sigma. You also show that in the limit of small k, you produce this complicated dispersion relation into something linear in k, and as a result, the coefficient in front of k will be the speed of sound. And you'll find the speed of sound is imaginary for some particular values of sigma. And as a result, if sigma lies in this range where you can have an instability and you can have real propagation of sound or phonons through the solid, what that will imply is the possibility of this spontaneous distortion. And as a result, this theory is intimately related to the ferroelectric, or the behavior of ferroelectrics at the transition temperature. The point is that although we haven't said anything about ferroelectrics, you have the knowledge in hand now to derive some properties of them. And so that's what you'll do in part one, or problem one. In problem two, you'll then consider ferromagnetic behavior. In particular, in ferromagnetic materials, there's a so-called spin wave known as a magnon. A magnon is a spin equivalent of a phonon. And as a result, the theory, the thermal properties of magnons, you can also derive. I give you some properties of magnons, just like in class how we began the analysis. I give you some properties of photons, then we derive some things. I give you the properties of phonons. We derive some things, and I'm giving you the properties of magnons. You're going to derive some things, including the density of magnon states, the density of states for magnons. Show that there's some maximum magnon angular frequency, analogous to the Debye analysis of phonons. And finally, we'll be able to calculate the magnon-specific heat, and it'll be T to some power, and what you'll calculate is what that power is. Again, applying the analysis technique of Debye to this case. And what's different about it, among other things, is that the dispersion relation for magnons is quadratic. And we haven't looked at a quadratic dispersion relation for anything which is a boson yet. So this is an example of that. Final problem, part three, is what we'll be covering in class today. What you should do is read this article by Griffiths that we've been going through in class, which is looking at waves in locally periodic media. And in Griffiths, in that section two, which is on quantum mechanics and solid-state physics, he looks at two interesting problems. One is that of a periodic array of delta function barriers. And we did the single delta function barrier before. With the analysis that we're going to do in class today, we'll be able to now calculate what is the transmission coefficient for 1, 2, 3, 5, 26 delta functions. And I want you to employ the approach which he has developed and actually computationally determine what the transmission coefficient is as a function of energy, and do this using your favorite mathematical software, MATLAB, Mathematica, Maple, whatever it is you prefer, and reproduce figure 4 from that paper. Part B is the other interesting case that he looks at, and that is the case of a particle in a box, infinite square well potential in 1D, where we add now delta function potentials inside of that box. And the specific case you'll consider is 25 delta functions inside of a particle, or inside of an infinite square well. What happens to the stationary state energies? And we'll find the stationary state energies will split. And if you have 25 of these delta functions inside of the particle in a box problem, instead of having one energy level for the ground state, that will split into 26 different levels. The second, or the first excited state, will split into 26, etc. And so what I want you to calculate and plot are the first 104 energy levels for this particular problem. And that's figure 7 of this paper. So you can check, make sure you did it right, because you're trying to reproduce that. Again, this is amenable to a computer. Doing it by hand, if you had to calculate 104 energy levels, that would be untenable on a reasonable time scale. But computationally, once you figure out how to do one, then you just have to run it. And if you're clever, you can make a loop in your program, etc. So I want you to go ahead and do these calculations. And the reason is, I just spoke with Professor Lahan yesterday in his course, Metamaterials. Similar calculations will be expected of you. So this is your chance to practice. Okay? Any questions on the homework? If not, then let's complete the analysis so you can do the third problem. What we did last time is we developed some formalism, which is going to be very convenient in the next step of the problem. The formalism we developed was for one arbitrary potential barrier. We now want to consider the problem of n potential barriers, that is local periodicity. So now we will consider a locally periodic potential with capital N periods. And so let's draw what we're talking about. Again, we're assuming one dimension, a real potential. And we're going to say that it's going to exist, at least the first period of this periodic potential will exist between minus A and A. And this will be some potential. If we want a distance, or if we said the periodicity of this potential was S, then this location in space would be negative A plus S, and this would be A plus S, right? Because as we go from here to there, that's one period, so we're going to go to A plus S to get there, and similarly minus A plus S to get there. There's going to be capital N of these. The last one would exist the leftmost side of this would be negative A plus capital N minus 1 times S, and would go to the other side, which would be A plus capital N minus 1 times S. So that's the final one, and there's going to be N of these periods between this point in that point. What we can now do is break this into regions in space, and in particular, the region for x less than minus a, we're going to say has a wave function psi naught. Between a and minus a plus s, we'll have a wave function psi sub 1. There'll be a bunch of other psis, and then finally, to the rightmost side of the final period will be psi sub capital N. What we want to relate is psi sub capital N sub to psi sub naught, which would tell us the transmission through these N periods. Okay. So our objective is to construct the transfer matrix for the entire array given the transfer matrix for a single cell. This is exactly what we want, because we spent the first half of the course figuring out how to handle a single cell. We know exactly how to do that. We just simply solve the Schrodinger equation here, and we connect the three regions together with boundary conditions. And that's something which is at least manageable. You're going to have four equations and four unknowns in most cases like that. And once we have that, the question is, can we generalize this to capital N? If we couldn't generalize it to capital N, then you'd have to apply 4 times capital N. So if you had 25 delta functions like you're going to do in the homework, you'd have to apply 100 boundary conditions. This clearly is not something that we'd like to do if we can avoid it. Is everybody clear about the setup? Okay, so the problem is clear. Let's analyze it. Let's first write down what the wave functions are between the cells. So the wave functions between the cells, we'll have the following form. Psi sub n, where n is referring to this subscript here, so that would be 0, 1, etc. Psi sub n is going to be equal to some coefficient a sub n times e to the I k x minus ns. Right? If we're at psi naught, we know it's simple. It's just e to the I k x. But if we were to displace by one period, then we have to have an x minus s, x minus 2s, etc. Plus b sub n, e to the negative k, x minus n sub s. And this will be true for the region in space of n minus 1 times s plus a less than x less than n sub s minus a. Where n will be 0, 1, 2, up to capital N. Okay. So what I've done is written down what the wave function will be in each of these positions between the potential barriers. From this, we can just plug in some numbers. Let's calculate psi naught. We see that is simply a naught e to the I kx plus b naught e to the negative ikx, which should be true for x less than minus a. Right, that's obvious. We know that. We've done it a million times. Psi sub 1 will be a1 e to the negative iks e to the ikx plus b1 e to the iks times e to the negative ikx. And that will be true for a less than x, less than minus a, plus s. So that would be that region in space. It's the same solution except with the new coefficient a1 and b1. And of course, it's displaced in space, x minus s. So we can pull out a negative iks in this one and a positive iks in that one. Therefore, using our previous transfer matrix analysis, we can write down that a naught, b naught, right? That would be the a and b coefficients from last time, which are on the left-hand side of the potential, are related to the C and D coefficients, but the C and D coefficients to the right-hand side of this potential include A1 and this e to the negative IKS and this B1 e to the IKS. And they're going to be related by the transfer matrix, which we showed last time. We'll have the general form of WZ, Z star, W star, times CD, where C now is A1E to the negative IKS, and D is B1 E to the IKS. And as a result, we can do this matrix multiplication and see that A naught, B naught is equal to WE to the negative IKS, ZE to the IKS, Z star E to the negative IKS, W star E to the IKS times A1 B1. So we've related the coefficients by the transfer matrix of a single potential and these conditions which are related to the periodicity of this locally periodic potential. Similarly, we can show that A1, B1 will also be equal to W e to the negative IKS, Z e to the IKS, Z star e to the negative IKS, W star e to the IKS, times A2, B2. And if it's not obvious, you could go ahead and do the analysis using this general form that we just developed. And you'll find that this is, in fact, the case. Interestingly, you'll see that the relationship between A0, B0, and A1, B1 is the same matrix as between A1, B1, A2, B2. And so if you did this n times, you'd get this matrix raised to the nth power to relate the two sides, that is psi naught to psi capital N. So in general, we can see that A sub n, B sub n is going to be equal to some matrix P, A n plus 1, B n plus 1, where we've just shown that this matrix P is equal to W e to the negative IKS, Z e to the IKS, Z star e to the negative IKS, W star e to the IKS. This is true between any pair which are displaced by one another by one period. Employing this relationship recursively for the capital N periods of our locally periodic medium, therefore relates A naught, B naught, which is psi naught, to psi n, which we represent by A n, B n, by P raised to the nth power, A sub n, B sub n. Okay. And as a result, this problem reduces to calculating the nth power of a 2x2 matrix. Okay, now as it turns out, this is much easier said than done and requires a significant amount of linear algebra. So I'm going to not take you through that in detail. It's of course outlined in gory detail in Griffith's paper if you're interested. And if you're a linear algebra jock, it'll be no problem for you. But let's not spend 2 days doing linear algebra. Let me just say that using several tricks from linear algebra, a it can be shown that so there's an expression that can be derived for this nth power of 2 by 2 matrix P. I have to admit, it's kind of interesting linear algebra if you're into that type of thing. But like I said, let's just cut to the chase and write down the result. It can be shown that P to the capital nth power is equal to P times U sub n minus 1 times Z, this Greek letter, minus I U sub n minus 2 Z. Incidentally, some people call this Xi or Z. It's Xi. I actually looked online to see how it's supposed to be pronounced. And there's a lot of debate on the internet about this. It seemed like Z was winning, so I chose Z. Okay, it's this symbol, okay? Where, you know, maybe someone who's in a fraternity or sorority can tell me how you pronounce this. Maybe not. Okay. I'm going to call it Z. All right, this is Xi. Where Z is equal to 1/2 times the trace of P. Now, the trace of a matrix is the sum of the major diagonal. So I'll spell this out explicitly in a minute. I is the identity matrix, which is 1, 0, 0, 1. U sub n of Z is equal to the nth Chebyshev polynomial of the second kind. Fortunately, these second kind Chebyshev polynomials can be written very succinctly, so we'll do that in a minute. So don't be intimidated by it, it's just some function. In our case, Z is of course 1/2 times the trace of P, where P is defined right here, and the trace is the sum of the positive, or the major diagonal. So this will be equal to 1/2 times W e to the negative IKS plus W star e to the IKS. And as a result, the transfer matrix for the entire array of n cells will be given by not just p to the n, right? Because p to the n just gives us capital A sub n, B sub n. But in that final region in space, we're also going to have another term which goes as e to the ik capital ns and e to the negative ik capital ns. So that still needs to be folded in to get the full transfer matrix. And so the true transfer matrix, which I'm going to call capital M sub n, will be P to the nth, which gets us to A sub n, B sub n. And then an additional factor, which we can write in terms of matrix, is e to the ik capital ns 0, 0, e to the negative ik capital n times s. This is just resulting from the fact that that last term will have this additional factor, like all the others did, which will be equal to, using our definition of p to the nth power, we can go ahead and plug this in and perform the matrix multiplication. And what we get is the following. W e to the negative iks times u sub n minus 1 as a function of z, minus u sub n minus 2 is a function of z, e to the I kns. So that's the 1-1 element of the transfer matrix. Let's go down a row. The 2-1 element will be z star u sub n minus 1 z e to the I k n minus 1 s. We have two more that we have to do. The upper right-hand corner of this matrix will be z times u sub n minus 1 e to the negative I k n minus 1 s. And finally, the lower right-hand corner will be w star e to the I k s u sub n minus 1 minus u sub n minus 2 e to the negative I k n s. Okay. So it really looks like a mess. And this is where all the work we did last time is going to pay off. So we're going to find that we're going to be able to express this much more simply, because we don't need every term in this transfer matrix to determine what we're trying to find. Okay. So all I've done here is just done the math. The point, though, is that this is a form of the transfer matrix. The only thing that we need to know that we don't know is W and Z. And W and Z are determined from the transfer matrix of 1, period. And as a result, if we know the transfer matrix for a single cell, i.e., we know W and Z, we can immediately write down the transfer matrix for n cells. And that would come from this matrix right here. So you can always go back here. This is true always. But we can simplify it further, and we'll go ahead and do that, because this is not particularly intuitive. At least, it's not particularly intuitive to me. Looks like a mess. So let's see if we can simplify. What we'll first try to calculate is the transmission coefficient through capital N barriers. And we're going to employ the same analysis we did before. That is, we'll assume that the wave is incident from the left, and as a result, there'll be no wave incident from the right, which will set D to 0. And then we can divide everything through by capital A to normalize it, and therefore calculate a transmission coefficient, which will be C over A. So let's do that analysis. So in particular, the transmission probability for incidents from the left, i.e., D0, will be AB is equal to M times CD, but now D is 0. And as a result, if we were to do this matrix multiplication, the only term that would survive for A will be M11, because 0 would be multiplied by M12. And so it tells us that A is equal to M11 times C, which implies that C over A squared is simply 1 over M11 squared. And so that's good. This transfer matrix, of course, has 4 elements to it, but to get the transmission probability, we only need one of the elements. So we made the problem easier, at least by a factor of 4. So from this, we would conclude that T is equal to 1 over M11 magnitude squared. And so we could calculate the upper left-hand corner, take the magnitude squared of that, and we would be done. But of course, if we look at this, the upper left-hand corner is not the easiest term in this matrix. The upper right or lower left would be even easier. So can we somehow utilize the constraints we developed last time to relate the upper left to the upper right and therefore simplify the calculation further? And so recall that we came up with these constraints last time. In particular, we said m11 magnitude squared minus m21 magnitude squared equals 1. Furthermore, we said that m21 equals m12 magnitude squared, and as a result, m21 magnitude squared is equal to m12 magnitude squared. And as a result, m11 magnitude squared will be equal to 1 plus m21 magnitude squared, just rearranging the first constraint. Then substituting in the second constraint, we see that this is also equal to 1 plus m12 magnitude squared. And as a result, we can see that the transmission coefficient is 1 divided by 1 plus m12 magnitude squared. So in the case where we have n barriers, the transmission coefficient will be 1 divided by 1 plus the magnitude of the upper right-hand corner. And as a result, t sub n, the transmission through n periods, will be 1 over 1, or 1 plus m12 magnitude squared, which we can see in this case, the beauty is that magnitude squared of that upper left-hand function knocks out that e to the ik term. All we're left with is that the transmission coefficient through n periods is 1 plus the magnitude of z times u sub n minus 1 z quantity squared. And so that's very succinct. All we have to determine is z. Remember, z was a function of both w and z. Take the magnitude of z, square it, sum it with 1, take the reciprocal, and you're done. So it's actually very simple to do this calculation once we get to this point. And in particular, since we're probably not that familiar with Chebyshev polynomials, let me point out that these polynomials can be written in the following form. Interestingly, if you're an electrical engineer, you're quite familiar with these polynomials because they're so-called Chebyshev filters, which are useful to get multi-pole response in a high-pass or low-pass filter, for example. So if you do any electronics, you may have seen these before. But in case you haven't, let me just tell you that they can be written in the following form. Sine, which is a function we all know, n plus 1 times gamma divided by sine of gamma, where gamma is equal to the arc cosine of z. Okay. So that is now something which is very easy for us to calculate. And in particular, let's go ahead and take this definition of the Chebyshev polynomial and plug it back into this equation. So we can write that capital T sub n is therefore equal to 1 plus the magnitude of z squared times sine n gamma divided by sine gamma squared to the negative 1. Where gamma we just defined, it's equal to arc cosine of z. And z we defined earlier. Z was 1 half of w, or 1 half times quantity w e to the negative iks plus w star e to the iks. Question?
The gamma in the numerator is part of the argument for the sine.
Yep. Yes. So remember, this is u sub n minus 1. And so the n minus 1 plus 1 cancel. It's another nice feature here, is that it's very succinct form. So all you have to do is determine w, determine z, plug in magnitude squared of z here, and then calculate gamma, which is arc cosine of z. And z is coming from the sum of w. So both W and Z are required, and of course the periodicity matters. All the terms which we would expect to be relevant come into this equation. There's one more thing that I want to go over, which will make the analysis even simpler. So you can always go back to here if you want, but this is kind of a mess, and you can simplify that equation and make the calculation even simpler. And what you'll find is that it's, at least for the first part of that third problem in the homework, this is a simple one, it's basically a one-step equation. Maybe your program, your MATLAB program, will have three or four lines in it to calculate the transmission through an arbitrary number of delta functions. So that first problem is very straightforward. The second one's a little bit more complicated. You have to solve an equation in order to get the answer. You'll see that when you do it. But let's try to simplify Z because we need to know that. So Z, we said, is 1/2 W e to the negative IKS plus W star e to the IKS. And as a result, we can write it in the following form. W we can express as the real part of W plus I times the imaginary part of W. E to the negative IKS, we can use Euler's formula to express as cosine KS minus I sine KS. The second term, of course, will be the real part of W minus I, imaginary part of W, because it's the complex conjugate of W. And e to the IKS is cosine KS plus I sine KS. And so we have to execute these two products. We'll do that. You may see where I'm going, but I'll just spell it out. It'll be equal to 1/2 real part of W cosine KS plus I imaginary part of W cosine KS minus I real part of W sine KS plus imaginary part of W sine KS. Now we'll execute the second product plus the real part of W cosine KS minus I imaginary part of W cosine KS plus I real part of W sine KS plus imaginary part of W sine KS. And you can probably guess that we did this because there's going to be a lot of terms that cancel, and that's in fact the case. We'll see that this term cancels with that term. In addition, this term cancels with that term. We're going to have two factors of real part of W times cosine KS, two factors of imaginary part of W times sine KS. Those factors of two we can pull out and cancel with the 1/2. And as a result, we see that this is simply equal to the real part of W cosine KS plus the imaginary part of W times sine KS. And so these are the three equations you need. Once you know W, you take the real part, multiply it by cosine KS, take the imaginary part, multiply it by sine KS. That gives you Z. Take the arc cosine of Z to get gamma. You plug gamma into this equation in addition to the magnitude squared of Z. You square those terms, add to 1, take the reciprocal, you're done. And now you can very easily calculate the transmission coefficient for an arbitrary number of periodic potentials. And as a result, these results can be applied to several problems. And as I mentioned, in this class we'll focus on the quantum mechanical problems. We can also apply it to electromagnetic waves, acoustic waves, elastic waves, whatever wave you like. And in Lincoln Lahan's class, you'll look at electromagnetic waves. They can be applied to several problems. For example, the transmission probability f through a periodic delta function potential. I'll show you a plot of this in 1 second. This is figure 4 from Griffith's paper, which you'll be reproducing in the homework. You can calculate the energy levels for delta functions in the infinite square well. And again, you'll be calculating this. This is figure 7. I'll put it up on the board in a second. This problem here is very similar to Kronig-Penney, except we have a finite number of delta function potentials. In Kronig-Penney, we said there was an infinite number. You can reproduce the Kronig-Penney model from this analysis by joining the tail of your array back on the head of the array, just as we did with the ring analysis we did last time. And as a result, by joining the tail of the array to its head, the Kronig-Penney model is recovered. And Griffith does this explicitly. I leave it as a reading assignment if you're interested. So that's good. What we're going to see now is, in Kronig-Penney, we assumed a very large number. Capital N was 10 to the 23rd. What I'm going to put on the board now is a plot for 4, 5, 10, 25 periods. And we'll see band structures obviously clearly evident. You then may ask, well, maybe this analysis is artificial, because in a real solid you have surfaces. Maybe the surfaces play a bigger role than I'm leading on. And so let's put those delta functions in an infinite square well, where we definitely have surfaces. And we'll see the same thing emerges. After only 25 atoms inside of this infinite square well, we'll have clear band structure emerging. So let's take a look. First case is figure 4. This is the transmission coefficient for periodic delta function potential. And what you're seeing in the upper left-hand corner is capital N equal to 1. We solved this problem in the first half of the course. And that was the transmission coefficient as a function of phi, where phi is some parameter which is related to energy. So you can think of this as a plot of energy. And as expected, as the energy increases, it's more easy to transmit through this delta function potential. However, when we go from 1 to 2, just a second barrier, interestingly, what we see is that there are going to be particular values of energy where we have unity coefficient for transmission. Again, this is something which is, you know, very hard to expect classically, that if I put a barrier in front of you, I can make it as if that barrier doesn't exist by putting another barrier after it. And that's what's happening in quantum mechanics. This plot here is the basis of the resonant tunneling diode. Or what you're going to do is create now two barriers. And if you try to tunnel through these two barriers, there'll be particular values of energy, therefore, of applied bias, where it's going to be as if there's no barrier at all. But if you go to a slightly higher bias, now the barrier closes, and as a result, the current drops. And so if you were to plot the current as a function of voltage for a double barrier potential, what you'd get is an increase and then a decrease, and an increase and a decrease. The slope of the IV curve will therefore become negative for those values where it's dropping. This is known as negative differential resistance, which is highly sought after in microelectronics because it allows you to implement logic and memory at reduced power consumption. Power consumption arguably being the most immediate problem for the microelectronics industry. So that's two. And you can do two analytically. And you know, I could have tortured you with that problem, but I didn't. But you can do two. But if I asked you to do three, you would have quit. You would have revolted. But now it's trivial. All we do is go back to our MATLAB program and we change capital N to 3 and we plot. and we get this plot here. And what you see is that there are some more wiggles that emerge. You see now instead of this peaking once, each of these peaks twice. How about 5? Again, trivial to do with your MATLAB or Mathematica program. You just change n to 5. And now you see that there's going to be multiple peaks in this case. 4 peaks existing for each of these original 1 peak for the double barrier problem. If we go to 26, we get to the following structure here, where now you can imagine there'd be 25 of these ripples at the top. And what's emerging now is the formation of bands. They're going to be particular values of phi, and therefore particular values of energy, where it's going to be almost perfectly easy to transmit through. Those will be allowed energies. And then there are going to be other energies where the transition probability is 0. All of that radiation would be reflected. All those waves would be reflected. Quantum mechanically, that would imply that those are no longer allowed propagating waves, and they would be forbidden. So we see, just with 26 periods, there's already a clear formation of band structure where there are band gaps and allowed bands of energy. So you'll do that in the homework. How about if we put these delta functions in a square well? Here are the energy levels for 25 delta functions in the infinite square well, and you'll calculate these in the homework. What you can see is that the ground state energy now splits into 26 different energies, and they form a band. And then there's an opening of a band gap. The first excited state will split into 26, and there'll be an allowed band, then another band gap, etc. So you can see clearly that even with only 25 atoms in this nanoparticle, if you want to think about it that way, we already have clear evidence for band structure that is emerging. And so you don't need to have a very large number of atoms, or you don't need a very large periodicity in order to see the consequences of solid-state physics. But there are some subtle differences. If you were to look here, obviously within this band, there is quantization that's present. And so you will see this transition from the continuum or macroscopic solid-state physics, where you have essentially continuous bands of allowed energies and then perfectly unallowed band gaps, to a case where you see something which is kind of like a band structure, kind of like quantization occurring concurrently. And the details of this behavior, of course, can be exploited in a variety of applications in the area of nanoscale science and technology. Are there any questions on this? Okay. So this concludes our analysis of band structure. As you can probably imagine, there's a lot more we could do on this, and in 451, if you take that, we'll go through some other more advanced approaches towards calculating band structure. But no matter how you slice it, you get the same result. As soon as you have any periodicity, you will have allowed bands of energy, you'll have band gaps, and at the band edges, the slope of the EK diagram will go to 0. What we'll consider in the remainder of the course, which is just a few lectures now, is the consequences of that band structure on the properties of materials. The one thing that we haven't talked about and has to be added back in is the statistical distribution functions, in particular for electrons, the Fermi-Dirac distribution function. The location of the Fermi-Dirac distribution function with respect to the band structure will dictate if a material is highly conductive, highly insulating, or something in between. In particular, if the Fermi level or the chemical potential existed inside of a band, then we're going to find that this material will be extremely conductive. On the other hand, if the Fermi-Dirac distribution function were in the band gap and you were at zero Kelvin, then we know that we'd have a completely filled band and then a completely empty band. There'd be no partially filled bands, and that would be a perfect insulator. Where life becomes interesting is when you turn on temperature and the Fermi-Dirac distribution function broadens, you have the possibility of having a partially filled conduction band, a partially unfilled valence band. Both of these will be able to conduct charge, but if you recall, at the top of a band, that would be in the valence band, the EK relationship has a concave down relationship, and as a result, the effective mass will become negative. We'll correct for that seemingly difficult concept by reversing the sign of the mass and also reversing the sign of the charge. So think about those empty states at the top of the valence band as being positively charged holes, which will conduct in the opposite direction as the filled electron states in the conduction band under the application of applied bias. We'll analyze this statistically, calculate things such as conductivities, mobilities of charge carriers, and that will conclude the course. Okay, any final questions? If not see you next time.
MSE 405.